What does Australia's next generation of young leaders have to say about the future of India-Australia relations in a post-COVID world? And how do Indian scholars, scientists, practitioners, and students factor in? You're listening to Shared Visions, the podcast that spotlights the Australian government's new Colombo plan and gets to the heart of these questions. Today, we speak with Jeff Flugi, an analyst at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation in the UAE, and Dhruva Jaishankar, the director of the US Initiative at Observer Research Foundation.
My name is Jeff Flugi. I basically came into NCP in the 2018 cohort. I initially crossed paths with Dhruva as my thesis or honors supervisor put me in touch as someone I absolutely needed to meet up with in Delhi, and out of that came an internship. So I'm currently UAE based and I work here as an analyst, primarily looking at South Asia and the Indian Ocean.
And Dhruva?
I was based in New Delhi working at a think tank called Brookings India. It is then affiliated with the Brookings Institution in Washington. And I was a fellow there managing some of their foreign and security policy programs. And I was put in touch with Jeff via Roy Metcalf, who is at the Australian National University, a longtime India hand there, as continues to have a deep interest in the country. And he highly recommended Jeff and said, was, you know, any possibility for him to intern while he was at Delhi? And I said, absolutely, it'd be great. And so Jeff spent a few months with us at Brookings India, did some of his own research there on India-China relations, managed to travel to places like Sikkim to do some field work, and also helped me with some work on India-Australia relations, which actually was just published 2 days ago, in fact, by the Lowy Institute. So Jeff was really helpful in compiling some of the basic stuff that went into that. And so it's nice to see almost, I think, 2 years later, the fruits of that, those labors. So that's helpful. I mean, I was at the time developing much more of an interest in Australia. I actually made 4 trips to Australia in 3 years. In any case, this really helped in that helped advance that, and in that sense we benefited from the new Colombo plan.
I guess since you just mentioned the paper that was published in the Lowy Institute, that's a good starting point for the discussion, because I just read through the whole thing very recently, and I know I'm not someone from the policy or the governance space, so it's interesting for me to try and parse the information and find sort of the key takeaways. But it sounds as if, though, both of you are optimistic about, relationships between India and Australia. And there's kind of a lot, there was a lot of work to do, but the trajectory seems hopeful. At least that's what I gauged from reading the paper. Just reading about things like the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership from this past June, and other sort of avenues of collaboration. So I would just love to hear both of your thoughts on this idea, and what you would both have to say about that.
Well, I'd be eager to hear Jeff's thoughts in particular, but just quickly on the paper itself and some of the conclusions. I mean, I would agree that broadly it gives a more what I tried to do in some ways was document the trajectory, and I think you can conclude by reading it that it is a positive trajectory. In fact, right. I think The Australian just ran a story yesterday on that, which kind of drew the same conclusion. But it's a little bit at odds with sometimes the day-to-day issues that make the news, which are often obviously of a more critical, negative nature. It's the squeaky wheels that create the loudest noise. So whether it's the Adani mine issue or the Indian students in Australia or the nuclear issue or the Quad collaboration, it's always the negative things that make the news. So anyway, part of it was sort of just documenting that trajectory, and I think it is overwhelmingly positive, particularly on the security side, which is what I focused on. But equally, I think one thing I did not focus on at length is I think the people-to-people ties have really taken off. I mean, if you look at where, again, particularly prior to the coronavirus pandemic, where do Indians go to study? Where do Indians go on tourism? and two-way, but that is really, I think, a major transformation in the relationship. Other things I think are going to be difficult and are a little bit more difficult. I'm less optimistic on the trade front, for example, because I think the expectations are very different, and it'll be hard in a post-coronavirus world. So it's not only a good story, but I think the positives certainly outweigh the negatives. But I'd be eager to hear Jeff's view.
Yeah, so I think, it's a fantastic overview and give some great recommendations for how to bring the relationship forward. From my own perspective and my own experience in Delhi and indeed in Australia, I'd say that it's really important to acknowledge the long memory that the strategic community in Delhi has. And I think there have been stumbles along the way. There have been tensions at different times. And I think what Dhruva captures really well is that despite some of these issues, the future is looking very bright. And I think when you look at future engagement and the comprehensive strategic partnership that was just signed, it is a clear signal that things are changing for the better. I would agree that certainly there are still challenges in bringing some depth to that relationship. And if you look at the economic aspects of it, I think there's been a lot of work done in that area, specifically the India economic strategy that was released by Peter Varghese, that really looked at the relationship to 2035 and brought a very targeted approach to economic engagement, which I think is very valuable. And anecdotally, from my time on the ground, the feedback I had, away from the strategic community, a lot of the things that they wanted to see were largely covered in that. But it remains to be seen, what substance can be brought, in that respect. But
by your experience on the ground, you mean in India?
Yes, yeah, in Delhi. Probably touch on it later, but it comes to the people-to-people ties aspect of this relationship. And I think although I spent a good deal of my time in the strategic community, the strategic space in IR, I was also very much engaged outside of that area in places like tech startups, with people doing research into millennials and domestic politics and in all of these very different and very interesting areas. And I think, that's what in-country experience brings. So, yeah, I think people-to-people ties in defense and the broader strategic relationship are phenomenal and have been for some time. But I think in the periphery, from our perspective, I think they've grown a lot in recent times as well, and I think that's probably what gives me even more hope is that beyond the cold analysis of academia, we have a lot of awareness being built through education ties, through various other facets of trade, where I think there is an appreciation for the role that Australia might be able to play in the future. Beyond the pure security and strategy aspects,
right? So you kind of both of you mentioned this, the importance of this, the people to people ties, which is kind of it's not exactly like a piece of quantitative data that you can put out on a piece of paper, right?
Yes.
But Jeff, I mean, you were kind of immersed like directly into the policymaker space of India and specifically of New Delhi, which, as you mentioned when you wrote to us, is kind of an incredibly complex space to navigate. So I'm just curious to hear what your experience was like, especially as a student coming into it. Like, what was that experience kind of like, and how were you able to navigate it with Dhruv's help and otherwise?
Yeah, so I think, yes, absolutely. It is a complex space. And I think COVID-19 has given me a far greater appreciation for the importance of being either face-to-face or or present in that space. And I think that's particularly important in a place like India and specifically New Delhi. Certainly when I got to Delhi after, some revision of my initial study plan, it only took 2 or 3 months for me to realize that, there were going to have to be significant changes along the way if I wanted to do what I set out to do in terms of independent research. And certainly Dhruva's help in terms of opening a lot of doors for me, in terms of my own research, but also just guidance and structure. I think unlike many NCP scholars who come in to do coursework, although I was affiliated with OP Jindal Global University, and they were very helpful and I was in touch with them throughout my time, I was really doing independent research. And that presents its own sort of issues in terms of structure and trying to stay on time and produce some reasonably decent work. So I think, you know, my first internship in Delhi was at Brookings India, and it was a phenomenal experience just because it gave me, just by proximity, exposure not only to, great mentors like Dhruva and also Constantino there at Brookings, but also the other interns I worked with were in their own right, exceptional young leaders in India. So I think, for one thing, that the structure was really important, but as much as there was structure, there was also a lot of flexibility. And I think that Dhruva was able to give me a fairly, was able to give me plenty of space to go and make my own mistakes and go and burrow into some archives and look into various things that may not have ended up in my final research, but were incredibly helpful in really understanding the layers upon layers that exist in that space. So,
right.
Yeah, I think, NCP, the value of NCP is largely in that flexibility at the scholar level. It's a bit different for mobility programs, but I don't know any NCP scholar that didn't change their course of study after the first few months. And after 3 months at Brookings, I sort of thought, I had a phenomenal plan, but there are some other really interesting avenues that I get to explore after this. And I think, that's what both the scholarship and mentors like Dhruva bring to the program.
Yeah, so again, coming back to, the paper that was recently published and sort of the things that you guys wrote to us. As I said, there's a couple of things that, are a bit esoteric, at least conceptually, for me to grasp. So I guess I had a couple of questions just for myself, but also for anyone who may be listening, for some of these things that some of these things that are leading to the optimism that you guys are having. So for example, the security cooperation stuff, for example, both of you are saying that there are lots of partnerships that are happening strategically and in the security space. I was curious about, if you could just expand on those a little bit and, what that means for India-Australia relations, as well as, and the other thing that stood out to me was, these things that are called Track 2 diplomatic and digital initiatives. So I'm kind of curious about both of these two things, and if we could just talk a little bit about those.
Yeah. So I think it's really interesting in this day and age how this relates quite directly, I think, to the New Colombo Plan, how sometimes societies interact with each other, and sometimes governments, states. If you think of a state as both a government, which is a formal representation of the state, and then the society, the people, they interact with each other and often at different rates. And so you have some countries with which, for example, India has very close government-to-government ties, but there's, I would take even India and Japan, for example, or even India and Russia, where the government-to-government relationship is quite strong, but there's still quite limited people-to-people contact. Some of it is language, some of it is culture, for a variety of reasons.
Right.
And you have other relationships where, in fact, the social relationships are much stronger, and the governments are running behind. And in some ways, that has marked over the last few years India's relationship with much of the Anglophone world. I mean, the UK, US, Australia as well. And so sometimes you have one leading the other or one holding the other back. And in this case, the security relationship in some ways is playing catch up with what has been a much more organic relationship that has formed between India and Australia over the years. So actually, I'm not sure Jeff knows this, but I actually, when I was 12 years old, 11 years old, I was a student in India, and I went on an exchange program. My school had an exchange program with a school in Australia. And so I traveled from Delhi with five other children in my class to Melbourne, to a suburb of Melbourne. We were put in a local elementary school and spent a month there. And at that time, it was extremely exotic for an Indian. You know, the six of us were like, it was felt like we were being sent to the moon or something like that. It was just very hard for Indians. This was in the early 90s. They just weren't those opportunities, and there was a very competitive process in our school for we want to be one of the six who would go, and I was lucky enough to get it.
Yeah.
But that was, you know, for me a great experience. I mean, it was my first time in Australia. I lived with the family there for a month. Today that I'm saying is what was so different, what was so unusual then, is today a much more regular type of engagement. You know, people go study, you have family there, you have your friends there. Their cross collaborations and part of it is the benefits of this world. So I think that the security relationship in some ways is playing catch up to that to that reality. The second element, what you said on track twos, is also about that interaction. So track two dialogues are traditionally areas where the governments previously could not talk on issues or just too sensitive or too difficult, and track two dialogues were set up often with the help of governments. To facilitate that dialogue, you know, so the U.S. and Soviet Union had track two dialogues on sensitive issues where experts would meet with each other, often in third countries, to facilitate conversations that the governments could not have face to face. That's become so normal. There's a proliferation of track two dialogues like that. Sometimes the government is even less involved because they don't have to be. Sometimes it's on less sensitive issues. But that being said, there still are ways where non-government entities can help move a conversation along more radically. So say on technical subjects, so that's where digital cooperation comes in, where the governments don't have the capacity, and then they come at that issue later. So we have seen, again, a proliferation of India-Australia track two dialogues. There's a very good initiative run. There's a youth leadership initiative, for example, that's been very successful. I never took part in it, but Australia-India Youth Dialogue, but many sort of young Indian leaders have. There's another one that is focused on parliamentarians, and so we've had, you know, pretty much half the cabinet in Australia has at some point taken part in a parliamentary dialogue with India, and a large number of Indian parliamentarians too. So again, these things have helped to build up that relationship from a time when, again, at the official level, it wasn't as warm or constructive a relationship to today, where in some ways these things have fulfilled their purpose.
Just to, I suppose, add my voice to that, I think, aside from cricket, where there is a very friendly rivalry, I get to... Yeah. I suppose revel in that a bit more, given a recent victory in a certain series. but yes, and I must actually say that I was no great lover of cricket until I wound up in India, and then it sort of just became a feature of my every weekend, and lived and breathed it for 12 months, and now I'm a convert, and I can't help myself in checking the score. But
that's great.
I would agree that, you know, there has been a lot of catch up in the relationship in the security space, and I think there's a real I think there's always been a real appetite for engagement, and we're just now realizing that in the security space. But I think, the friendships I've formed along the way in various different parts of India and on the other side back in Australia, I think it. I think it bodes well, very well for the future relationship.
So I guess acknowledging, you know, the current climate that we live in, with the reality of the global pandemic, it's obviously, as we previously mentioned, it's obviously made in-person collaboration a challenge. It's made it significantly more difficult to, do these kinds of more meaningful exchanges with people face-to-face. What does that say about the future of India-Australia relations to both of you? About we're moving, you know, this currently what we're doing right now, an example of what it's become, right? Everything is sort of being mediated digitally now. I'm curious, like in the policy space, you know, how does this change or shape the conversation?
There's no doubt that there's a bump in the road. And the question is really how big a bump this will be in hindsight and how long-lasting the effects of that will be. So, you know, a lot of it will depend on how quickly a vaccine is available, what protocols can be. I mean, already there's sort of steps towards normalization that people are trying to make, despite the fact that the coronavirus is still spreading in places like India quite rapidly, and places like Australia remain closed for fear of a return of the pandemic. But, you know, I point to a couple of things which make me at least slightly or cautiously optimistic, I would say, that we can return to, and perhaps even return better to a better place. One is that there is constant dialogue at the official level, even during the pandemic, on issues of how to get back, you know, to rebound from this. So, for example, at the recent G20 meeting, which was held virtually, one of the things that was discussed was, can there be a standardized protocol for international travel? That would mean that sort of if somebody's, you know, tested in a certain way in India, that it's recognized by the Australian government or vice versa. So, you know, just like we have, they're now so common security procedures everywhere before you board an aircraft, will there be common health screening procedures? So, I mean, the fact that that conversation is, I don't know if that'll lead to a result very quickly, because different countries will have different views about it and take the challenge more seriously than others. But the fact that they're even talking about this, how can we develop standard protocols so that we can return to a period of regular travel? Now, again, it could still be a slow recovery. A second example I would give, and this is one where Australia, India, and Japan are taking a leadership role, is the resilience of supply chains. So the three commerce ministers met virtually recently, actually agreed to set up by the end of the year an initiative for supply chain resilience. And that basically means that, you know, in the event of future crises also, that these countries can trust each other to supply necessary goods. I mean, I think a lot of it is in the backdrop of healthcare equipment, but it would apply more widely to other sensitive issues as goods as well. So again, the fact that Australia, India, and Japan feel the need to take the lead for it, at least for their region, is a good sign. And I would say a third thing is there's actually been some positive developments on because there's a realization that setting technical standards and with a sort of democratic bent to it is the need of the hour. And so you're seeing India and Australia amongst a dozen other countries starting to set the norms for the use of artificial intelligence, for the use of 5G. So there are international coalitions that have been forming over this. One initiative is actually a French-Canadian initiative called GPEG, a Global Partnership for Artificial Intelligence. But both India and Australia are amongst the founding members of it. So I give these as examples of some things that have happened just in the last 6 months as the coronavirus pandemic has been raging, where you see some of the early building blocks being put in place for how can cooperation accelerate in a post-coronavirus world. I still think there are a lot of obstacles, a lot of challenges ahead. These are not foregone conclusions. But it's good to also see that these kinds of conversations are happening at an official level.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, you know, I've been really impressed, but not necessarily surprised by the amount of virtual engagements I've been able to take part in or observe. You know, think tanks have been especially proactive in making sure content was out there, whether it be regards to COVID or otherwise. And I think, you know, even from my own perspective, I think in some spaces it's probably going to make engagement slightly easier or at least more regular in the future. I think there's a lot of multilateral organizations or indeed minilateral organizations in the Indo-Pacific who have woken up to the fact that you actually maybe don't need to be in the same room, you know, just twice a year. You can actually go ahead and, you know, meet up six times a year and four of those times can be virtual. And I think, you know, IORA, ASEAN, a number of other multilaterals have all held, G20, as Dhruva mentioned, have all held virtual meetings where they have had as good outcomes as any previous meeting. And I think, yes, there's valuable sideline talks that would occur at such meetings, and there will always be a need for that physical interaction. But amidst COVID, I think there's also been an acknowledgement of the value of being fairly proactive and in touch virtually, on those issues that perhaps aren't so sensitive. So for things, for broadly agreed upon cooperative measures, I think there is space for COVID to perhaps have some positive impact in future diplomatic engagements, despite closed borders. And I think, watching from afar, the regularity of dialogue, and I mean, even in the case of the Australia-India relationship, although state visits couldn't occur, there was still significant agreement signed, and I think that's indicative of the relationship itself, of course, but also the willingness to overcome some of the challenges that COVID brings to engagement. And in my view, yes, some of those cooperative aspects can be amplified and strengthened. And of course, in other respects, we're seeing even more fracturing and entering a very dangerous place as well, of course.
Yeah, thanks for both of your guys' insight into all of this. I just wanted to wrap by asking you, Jeff, about if you could just offer a few words on the NCP program itself. And just, someone in this particular space, I've been talking to a lot of people for the podcast, people in different lines of work, like biomedical science or teachers or mental health professionals. But the unique thing about this particular line of work is that, we're talking about India-Australia relations, and that is exactly what you're focused on in your work and what kind of you addressed during the program.
Yeah, I mean, I'm incredibly grateful for the NCP scholarship and the Australian government support in funding this program. And I think it's incredibly important. I think I wouldn't want to be quoted on it, but I believe over 60,000 Australian students have been recipients of some sort of NCP grant, whether it be mobility or the scholarships themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think, when we look at the impact that will eventually have in terms of, giving future leaders some Indo-Pacific literacy, I think that's incredibly important. And on my own personal level, I think the amount of flexibility I was given with my program to engage with institutions such as Brookings to get engaged to some extent on the 2019 elections and just be amongst that. That would be impossible to get anywhere else. And it's really only NCP. I don't know of any other program that would offer that level of flexibility and support, both in Canberra and through the High Commission in New Delhi, where I was really given support at every turn and every change, and I'm certainly better for it. And when I look at certainly my future career, I think it's certainly given me more appetite to be present and whether it be academically or as a professional in that India-Australia space. And I think from all reports from my cohort, that's been repeated all across the Indo-Pacific. And I think that's really the value of the program, is that there is we're growing and building this Indo-Pacific literacy and to some extent leadership. And I think of some of my cohort who have gone on to start their own youth dialogues. They've gone on to start their own organizations to start building and formalizing those people-to-people relations. And I think that's really important as well, is that although on an informal level I've benefited hugely, and personally, I think that's only made me want to try and share that and bring that to others. And I think everyone in that space is very proactive about it. And as it covers so many different sectors, we get a tremendous cross section of young people who are enthusiastic in their own realms. And I happen to be in international relations and strategic studies, but others in technology, biotech, law, whatever it might be, you know, they're engaging on that level. And I think those linkages are only going to grow in importance.